Next on RadioSt.Pete.com, today's Hillsborough County Emergency Policy Group meeting.
Thank you. We're now moving to public comment. The Emergency Policy Group, EPG, welcomes comments from citizens about any issue or concern. Your opinions are varied in terms of providing input to the EPG members. However, it is requested at the same time when you address the EPG that comments are not made directly at a personal against an EPG member, a staff member, or a presenter, but rather directed at the issues. This provides a mutual respect between the EPG members and the public. 20 minutes have been set aside for public comment. Our first speaker is Ryan Hatzinker.
Thank you, Commissioner Miller. Hasinski, I wanted to thank the commissioners again for hearing me out yesterday, and I also wanted to, more importantly, just say thank you for the EPG and the work that you guys are doing. I know often you're getting beat up in the press, but as elected leaders, you're called to a duty, and I appreciate that. I wanted to ask today, because part of the charter for the EPG is deals with mental health, and while we're waiting to possibly take action with amending the noise ordinance exemption for religious institutions, if it would be possible to pass something that would eliminate any kind of public outdoor concert right now, just because that would preclude them from continuing to do that. Last night was the first night where we did not have to listen to the music, mainly because of the rain. And so it was nice to not have that. But I'm also gravely concerned because when I watched, they went inside to the church, and again, no distancing, no masks. And I'm concerned about the health of my community because out of the 118 townhomes in Williams Crossing, there are approximately a dozen, maybe 14 that are owned by some of the churchgoers, and they pack these places in. As I wrote to Sheriff Cronister in late March, there's a potential for our community to become a viral vector. There's no good solution at this point with regard to whether they're doing the concerts outside, which again, the noise is constantly invading our home, or if they're doing it inside, then they're going to potentially create a viral vector in our community. So I'm just concerned at this point and wondering if there's any possible way where something could be passed temporarily to just preclude the outdoor concerts from happening because our mental health is suffering. We're not sleeping well. This has been every night since May 31st, except for last night, 45 days in a row. I'm a teacher. My wife's a teacher. It's summertime. We've had no rest or relaxation because of this. So hopefully there's something that you guys could do. I really appreciate your time in this matter, and I look forward to working with you moving forward with the VOCC in August. Thank you so much.
Before we move on, let me comment on this. We had, I think he was before the county commission yesterday. And as I said to the county commission, my office has been working on this issue and talking to Ms. Christine Beck. And we will continue to do that. This EPG has no, as far as I know, and I asked Ms. Beck to address this, has no authority provided by it through the ordinance from the county or the statutes in the state of Florida to handle issues such as noise from this church. Am I right, Ms. Beck?
Yes, Commissioner Miller, this is Christine Beck. The entities with jurisdiction would be the Environmental Protection Commission as well as the Hillsborough County Board of County Commissioners.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Joe Cosmo.
All right, thank you. I have a box of the same type of face masks that Hillsborough County has been handing out. It has a warning label on it. Warning, this product is an ear loop mask. This product is not a respirator and will not provide any protection against COVID-19, coronavirus, or other viruses or contaminants. By the way, why aren't there any biohazard bins for used masks and gloves if this virus is so contagious and deadly? June 20th, 2020, Washington Post. The test kits for detecting the nation's earliest cases of the novel coronavirus failed because of contamination at the CDC. MyFox8.com, April 1st, 2020. Coronavirus test kits meant for the United Kingdom found to be contaminated with COVID-19. So both the UK and US have faulty kits. That's interesting. July 14, 2020. Fox 35 Orlando. Sure, you guys have been hearing about this one lately. Florida Department of Health says some labs have not reported negative COVID results. So the reporting was being skewed to show more positive exposure. When COVID came out, they told us the death rate was 4.5%. Well, guess what? Even with these bogus numbers and faulty test kits showing positive when they should be showing negative, the official death rate is below 0.01%. That is 45 times lower than what they initially told us. Every one of these institutions are grossly incompetent or part of a larger conspiracy. You can decide. Only 192 deaths in Hillsborough County. That's 0.00013%. In 2017, the CDC reported 193 flu-related deaths for Hillsborough County. No masks, no lockdown, no social distancing, nothing. We keep hearing about abortionist rights. My body, my choice. Well, guess what? My health is my responsibility, not yours, and I don't want to wear a mask. My body, my choice. Is this about the virus or the election? Where we go one, we go all. Thank you.
Jennifer Cantor.
Good afternoon. Thank you guys for having me back. My name is Jennifer Cantor. A number of your callers recently have talked about the business reasons for wearing masks or for not wearing masks. And I wanted to bring to everyone's attention a recent report by Goldman Sachs, one of our leading investment firms in the country, where their chief economist said that linked universal use of face masks to being able to preserve approximately 5% of the GDP loss that we're anticipating through shutdowns or other business slowing because of outbreaks. I have emailed this to all the members of the EPG, and I would encourage members of the community to search Goldman Sachs, face mask, and GDP to see this themselves. In addition, I just wanted to say that I wanted to thank you guys for your service here at the EPG, and as your responsibilities shift to the Board of County Commissioners upcoming, I wish you guys a very calm and peaceful hurricane season. Thank you guys so much for your continued service.
Thank you. Keisha Casares.
I'm a nurse practitioner with over 25 years healthcare experience. First of all, I want to thank the EPG for their dedication to the health and safety of Hillsborough County residents. On June 16th, 1 month ago, the state of Florida reported 77,326 COVID-19 cases. Today, we are recording over 315,775 cases. Phase 2 reopening began June 5th. People let their guards down, social gathering became abundant, masks were not used, and 1 month later, here we are. This pandemic is a global experience. We should be learning from other countries that are defeating this virus. What have they done different? They did not politicize science. Mask wearing was widely accepted and not looked at as a violation of human rights. Lockdowns took place quickly and lifted slowly. This pandemic cannot be fought with misinformation, politics, and division. Citizens look to our leaders for guidance. The message from our leaders must be unified and based on medical and science evidence. I, too, want to get back to normalcy just like everyone else. I want to go on a cruise, see a movie, sit in a restaurant, and gather with friends. We must all come together to do our part to keep everyone safe. This will involve sacrifice from all of us. I encourage the EPG to continue to enforce any mitigation strategy necessary to keep our citizens safe. We look to our leaders to make decisions based on our best interests. Listen to medical and scientific facts, not political agenda, and appreciate that every human life is important. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Thompson. Catherine Thompson.
Can you hear me? Hello.
Yes, ma'am. Hello.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear Ms. Thompson?
I'm calling on a couple. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to call in regards to the caller on Monday who was silenced for mentioning a group member by name. I just wanted to say everyone in this group is an elected official. You open up this forum for your constituents to give their opinions. I didn't think the caller was threatening or vulgar in the statements that he made. As an elected official, you should listen with an open mind to what the taxpaying citizens have to say, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent. I hope the decisions you make are not only what you want, but based on what the people of your communities want. I realize you can't please everyone, and that is why I believe the mask mandate should be as strongly recommended. And you should trust the citizens who voted for you to make the right choices, as we are all adults and we are all capable of doing our own research and will do what we feel is right for ourselves, our family, and our community. Again, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Jason Kimball.
Hey guys, I actually really appreciate that comment. But so I have to question the motive of the members who are continuing to vote for mandatory face coverings. It's very disturbing because there are no randomized control tests to indicate masks are effective. In fact, all of the randomized control tests indicate they are not effective. The conclusion of an RCT on cloth masks actually states that cloth masks may result in increased risk of infection. So you guys are mandating these masks with no science behind them, and you are continuing to decimate the Hillsborough County community. I hope someone will have the strength to present a motion to remove the mask requirement today during this meeting. And to every member of this group who votes for the mask, you will be held accountable during the upcoming elections. Commissioner Merman, you will not be reelected. Your betrayal of the citizens of Hillsborough County has caused great damage, and it seems many of you have forgotten you are not rulers. You are elected into office. None of the tyrants who are imposing unconstitutional mandates will be reelected, and we are already gearing up for recall petitions. I want to remind the three particular members of this group that recall petitions will take you out of public office for at least 2 years. You will be unable to hold any office. But recall petitions should not be necessary. The lawsuit that Representative Sabatini and renowned attorney Chris Ann Hall have filed should not be necessary. Let's please use this meeting to get our act together and start moving forward on the correct path. Remove the mask mandate and do not even recommend face covering until experts can finally submit randomized control tests indicating that they are effective at preventing the spread of viral infections, any viral infection. Just submit a valid clinical study. Viruses have been around for a long time. Masks have been around for a long time. Where are these studies? I will be forwarding the randomized control tests already conducted to the EPG.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball. Your time is up. Elizabeth McEnery.
Yeah, can you hear me, guys?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you to the members of the EPG for giving me the opportunity to speak today. Before I start, I just wanted to say I totally disagree with the person before that, and each one of you has done an amazing job. So I just wanted to let you know that, and I applaud you. My husband and I reside in downtown Tampa. We both have Crohn's disease. We have stayed home for 4 months because we are concerned about going out because we have lost 6 family members. We have lost friends, and our doctor has lost over 50 people. Not all of them are in Florida. Some of them are in the tri-state area up north. But as we know, Florida is the epicenter of the world right now for COVID-19. We are being watched by everyone in the world. That is not something that any of us want to be, quote unquote, winning. Our governor has made poor choices. It's right out there for us to see. And he's evaded all accountability. What my family believes needs to be done and soon is a full shutdown of our state for at least 2 to 4 weeks, the way it should have been done before. Mayor Castro was right to do the safer at home. She got a lot of flack. She did it right, but then we opened too quickly. We were irresponsible. We followed the governor. It would be great if Hillsborough County could lead the way by setting the example and making a clear statement to our governor. What good are money, opportunity, rights in the economy if we are dead? It's horrible to have to say that right now, but it's true. I've sat on these calls for months listening to people attack you guys in the EPG in very disgusting manners. We, the everyday people, do not deserve to be overlooked any longer. Many of these callers are business owners with profit on the brain, just like our governor. They need to put their selfish behavior aside and maybe even their rights aside to save themselves and their neighbors. That's what a great community does. The peaceful demonstrations in our country were done very well. However, there should have been a limit to the activity based on the numbers back then. When we saw consistent case increases, we should have rolled back to phase one or a safer at home again. What I don't understand is how the governor can have his lawyers in these meetings, and then he responds by ignoring the community's cries for prompt protective measures. Are our state officials powerless to him? That's not an insult. It's a sincere question.
Ma'am, your time is up. Thank you very much.
Did not.
Thank you. The time is up. Thank you, ma'am. Juan Gonzalez.
Yes. Yes, thank you for your time. I just needed some guidance from this body. I'm a disabled veteran. I have difficulty breathing when I wear a mask. According to the recent mandate, mask coverings are required for customers that enter businesses. Now, I know there is that exception for people like myself who have a condition under your Section 9 Charlie, but I do have some questions. What sort of documentation would be required of me if a business still imposes that mandate onto me? I would prefer that the body doesn't push the requirement to the businesses, because then I'll have to carry a binder if Walmart wants this document and Publix wants that this other document. But do I need to disclose my medical condition and violate my medical privacy to enter the business? If the business still refuses me, is there any sort of remedy that I may have? Now, if a business does permit me to enter, how do you want me to respond if a customer challenges me about not wearing a mask and that challenge is very hostile? Is there maybe some symbol that I should wear that helps to identify me as having a health condition that inhibits my breathing with a mask? In fact, ladies and gentlemen, what sort of support can I expect from the Hillsborough County Emergency Policy Group if businesses also refuse to enter me, to allow me to enter into their establishment? Now, I'm trying to comply with the mandate. I want to comply with the mandate, but that's why I need this guidance, preferably in writing, so that I don't also cause the businesses to violate your emergency policy regarding this mask mandate. So any sort of guidance and advice that you can offer me so that I can comply but not violate these businesses would be very welcome. And I appreciate the time you've given me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ms. Beck, can someone from your office please get with that gentleman? We have his name and address, and contact him and talk to him briefly, please.
Yes, we would be more than happy to, and I just want to make it very clear that the ordinance does not require any documentation whatsoever to comply with that exception, but we will be happy to talk with him offline.
Thank you. That concludes our public comment. We're now moving to emergency management update. Mr. Dudley.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, we'll get loaded up here. All right. We continue to move forward with testing. Total tested to date, 63,786. Testing conducted this week as close of business on Wednesday, 4,487. Just a reminder, Town and Country new testing site scheduled to open tomorrow, Friday, at the Tampa Family Health Center on West Hillsboro. And this collection site will be in the evening and on Saturday. So that'll be Friday starting at 5 p.m. and on Saturday starting at 8 a.m. This week, we are seeing a slight decrease in demand at all our sites this week. But we continue to take appointments and schedule appointments and test folks out at the site and fill those requirements. Logistics focus this week. We have 32 guests checked into the isolation site. Logistics has 250 cloth face masks available for local hotels while supplies last. As of today, 25 hotels have submitted and received their requests. And this week, we're working with DOH to submit resource requests to the state for hospital systems with personnel shortages. We'll continue to monitor those resource requests and coordinate through DOH to help fulfill those shortages. And this concludes my updates. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Dudley. And I see no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Public health update, Dr. Holt.
Yes, sir. This is Dr. Holt, Florida Department of Health, Hillsborough County. Today we will provide an update on our epidemiology information and the hospital data. As usual, I'll provide a high-level review, and then Mr. Wagner will go through the graphs. I would note that while the data that he will present is the same, it's going to be presented in a new format as we evolve. Also, as requested, we've included the number of admits that come from the emergency room and the hospitalizations by age. After that, I will then review the data that regarding new cases over two-week periods by zip code. Okay, first slide, please. Second. The report here is 21,018 total cases to date. We did have 538 reported this morning, so we're at 21,559. Over the past 7 days, that's about a 30% increase. But again, as we've been noting, that is a slowing from our the trajectory of our reporting cases. To date, almost 1.5% of the population has been tested positive, have been confirmed as a case. We have had, to date, 0.01% of the population with a number of 192 deaths reported. Prior to today's number, where we added 38. The estimated number of recovered individuals is now 3,594. As I noted in that I expect this number to increase significantly beginning in early August as we start seeing those that were infected or reported infected in early July passing their 30-day level of still being surviving. Looking at the cases, our rolling 14-day average is now 679, an increase of 30%. Our 7-day is slightly higher, but both are stabilizing. Our test, we've also seen an increase, not quite as much as we've seen in our cases. I looked back since June 4th, our testing has almost doubled, but our cases have increased sevenfold. Our positivity rate is now 16.16 over a 14-day average, but again, showing a downward trend. I did look back, and as of June 4th, our positivity rate was 3.3%. We did peak at 20%, but we are now falling. There was a question about not reporting negatives. I did review a list that the DOH puts out. There's a list of 25 pages, about 50 labs. So totals about 1,200 labs that have reported. There were several that reported 100% or very high positivity rate, therefore not reporting any negatives. Most of these labs ran less than 10 total tests.
Excuse me, Dr. Holt, hold on. Would everyone please put their microphones on mute, please? Please put your microphones on mute. Continue, Dr. Holt.
My estimate, I didn't calculate exactly, that these labs together ran about 5,000 tests or 0.1% of the total tests to date. Next slide. Hospitalizations, you'll notice a change. We're using a source of data that is from the Tampa General and the Hospital Collaborative, Dr. Chang's. I think we've seen it. So it's a little different, the numbers, from what is reported by the hospitals to Agency of Healthcare Administration. Dr. Chang asked that I mention a couple of disclaimers in this data. First, there's a data lag of about 2 to 3 days. It takes that long for him to get all the information from all the hospitals and input it into his system. He also notes that there are some hospitals that have chosen not to report, so it's not a complete picture. Looking at our 7-day census, averaging is about 450 per his data. This is a 10% increase from our his previous 7 days. Bed occupancy is reported at 67%. This is below our 70% or our 80% target or concern of level. The 7-day average for ICU bed occupancy is 84%. This is, again, from his data, a 5% increase. That is a little above our 80% threshold. Noted in discussing with the hospitals, they are able to add COVID beds. They're doing some staffing surge, and they're working very hard to manage patient flow to maintain these numbers. COVID admissions have reported is 53. That's a 22% decrease from the previous day. This number does differ significantly from the ACA data presented, which reported cases in 68 yesterday and 64 on Tuesday. As Kevin will show you, if you look at the far right, those numbers are significantly different. As I've noted in the last week plus, we are seeing more patients being admitted from our long-term care facility. And this is by design in some cases, but there are symptomatic as well. Averaging over the past week, about 10 transfers a day. Deaths, we are reporting 192 in this, but as I mentioned, today we reported 38. That does not mean that that many people died today. The reports of deaths are a combination of the Department of Health and the medical examiner, and it sometimes takes a while to get their finalized before they do an official announcement. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Wagner.
Thank you, Dr. Holt. EPG members, Kevin Wagner, business analyst for the Healthcare Services Department. I'll start by saying a couple things. One, this format is different. It is a combination of efforts by the county's information department, communications department, healthcare services, and public health department of Florida to format this information. So it was a real coordination effort of those four entities. This is the initial version of a public-facing dashboard or website. We do anticipate changes and updates forthcoming in the future timeframe, but this is the initial version from a public-facing standpoint. The benefit of this effort is that it is an automated effort. We, the county, are not storing or manually adjusting the data. So again, we are not storing or manually adjusting the data. As the source data updates, our information will update. So again, I know there was a concern from a real-time perspective, but that is not something that we are able to break that bridge. But again, as the source data updates, ours will update. On the top row of the data, again, there was 21,000 cases. Today, there's 21,550. The total fatalities, again, were 195. Again, as Dr. Holt indicated, that has adjusted upward. The total estimated recovered is 3,594. That fatality rate is a calculation of the number of people who passed away based upon the total cases, not total population, as shown on the previous slide. Again, cases by gender on the bottom row is, again, predominantly female to male, around 53% to 47%. And your cases by age group on the far right-hand side of row three, again, still shows the younger population. The age grouping is a little different, but again, at the 20 to 30 age range, still is the highest aggregate age grouping. Trending cases by day. This is exactly the same information you've presented, seen before. Again, a different format, but again, you know, the rolling 7-day average is nearly 700. The 14 average of cases per day is 679. Again, this information is publicly available. testing information. This data is updated once a week from a testing component from the source of FDOH, but total tested residents were 191,000, which is equivalent to a little over 13% of the population. Again, a week lag data is 19,000 positive tests. We know that's a much higher number of 21,000. Again, automation of when data is updated. Again, the testing and positivity trend, which matches Dr. Chang's chart that you have seen before, again, shows an increase in total tests reported and the total positives over time. The hospitalizations, again, the source now we are using currently is the TGH, the hospital collaborative data. The crux of these slides is on the right-hand side in starting in June to July. We are seeing more hospitalized patients. So again, the 14-day average or 7-day average is around 450. We see a drop-off on the last day. But again, as Dr. Holt indicated, there was a delay in the information being provided through the source. But again, the trend is going upward, and we are hoping to see a flattening eventually. The daily hospital admits, again, this is something that we've presented before. The format, again, is different, but the data is the same. On average, every day, there's been 53 hospital admits on the 7-day average, again, as the data comes in. But we are seeing hopefully a flattening of this data, respectfully. When we talk about hospitalizations, we talk about the ICU and inpatient census. The pie chart is the total to date is nearly 19,000. Again, timing, that is the total inpatient hospitalized. And then on the far right-hand side, through hospitalizations by age group, trying to work on Ms. Snively's request, we see the hospitalizations by age group. Again, trending in the 50, 60, 70 plus age groups are the highest. Individuals presenting on row 2 of their emergency room visits, same information as presented before, as of July 5th, 115 on average for that week. So again, that information is the same. The difference is the appearance. With regard to Ms. Snively's request, looking at the number of admissions of COVID-related illness through the emergency department, FDOH provided their daily tracking report. So we are seeing a trend through July 12th of roughly about 50 a day based upon the tracking of completed cases through the FDOH process. This is unfortunately the closest that we can look at from a holistic standpoint of seeing the number of admits through the emergency room with COVID-related illness. So again, that is a number of qualifiers, but that is the closest that we can get because each hospital reports separately. This is the best aggregate available information. But overall, we have seen a trend increasing from June 15th to July. Hopefully, we're now seeing a flattening. Dr. Holt, this is now on the zip code information slide, sir.
Thank you, Kevin. So we'll begin with a couple of reminder points. COVID-19 cases are reported by where a person lives or resides. But COVID-19, like people, move around, so it doesn't necessarily mean where they were infected. But clearly, you do spend most of your time around people, particularly at home, neighbors, where you play, eat, work, shop. Back in April, when we had large outbreaks in our long-term care facilities, some of the numbers by zip codes were misleading, but that is no longer the case as we have had large numbers in the non-long-term care population. But what can influence this is if more people from a particular zip code gets tested compared to others, if their testing sites are close by. I do not believe that this is a large significant impact, but without access to the total number of tests done on by or of people in each of the zip codes, I really can't be certain. like to begin with the overview that the community-based transmission is widespread. If we look at our goal, which would be to get down to about one case per thousand, all of our cases, all of our zip codes exceed that number, and some ranging up to 14. I'd like to review next the difference between prevalence and incidence. The prevalence, when we talk about prevalence, that's the total number of cases throughout from the beginning that have been identified, and we divide that by the total population. So looking at our 21,000 plus cases in our 1.4 million population, that would be a rate cumulatively around that 14% or 14 per thousand. Incidence is what we're really looking at today. This is the number of new cases that occur in a specific time period. In this case, we chose 2 weeks, divided by the population. Epidemiologically, we look at this as called an attack rate. How active is the virus in these areas? So for the most recent 2 weeks period that ended 7/13, this number was 6.21 per thousand, or translates into about one in every 161 people. I think it's important to look at the this information over time. And so, as you recall, we opened our phase two. We entered phase two on June 5th. And things at that time looked quite good. Our average number of cases per day on a 14-day average was 49. And we had a positivity rate of 3.3%. But by the time we ended that 14-day period on 6/15, our rate had increased to 100 cases per day and a positivity rate of 7. That translated into an overall incidence of 1.2 per thousand. That's sort of, I guess I would call it our baseline, where we were at the beginning and towards the end. Over the next 2 weeks of the period ended 6/30, we all recall and we saw very significant increases. Certainly Governor DeSantis took notice. The Surgeon General, Dr. Ripkes, issued a public health advisory on social distancing, masks, if you're unable. And eventually Governor DeSantis also acted to close the bars. And then, of course, the EPG passed the mask ordinance on 6/22. So for that period of time, COVID was circulating. And at the end of that 6/30 period, we saw a 342% increase from the prior 2 weeks. We were seeing 450 patients or cases a day, and our attack rate had increased to 5.18 thousand, or one in 109. For our most recent 2 weeks, there is some good news. We are still seeing 680 average cases per day, but our positivity rate is starting to fall, and our attack rate has only increased 20% to 6.21. So we are seeing COVID spread slowing. We're seeing the flattening. I want to make a note that the only thing that really changes this is our people and their behavior. And so we really want to thank our public for endorsing the behaviors, personal responsibility, social distance, and facial coverings during this period of time. I believe that this has had an impact. I think everyone contributed. Everyone has kept their distance and, when necessary, worn facial coverings. But we always must be careful and be vigilant, because we are entering a continuation phase where the virus is still on the loose, and we must continue to keep it from spreading. Next slide, please. We'll go into the individual zip codes. We divided these up into three groups that I wanted to sort of highlight. One of them is going to be the highest attack rates. This is where the cases are the most active compared to the other population. We're going to look at several that have shown the greatest increases compared to where they were. I would term these as sort of the hot spots, if you will, the ones that have shown a significant change over that short period of time. And comparably or alternately, we've seen some that have shown significant decreases, sort of a cooling down. So this slide begins with the top, the zip codes where we had the highest number of cases per thousand. We chose any zip code over 9, but certainly there's several right below it that could have been included, but this is just to sort of demonstrate the table that we've provided. So beginning with 33607, if you'll notice, moving from left to right, this is a zip that has remained in the upper tier, if you will, with red. The good news, if you look at the increase over a two-week period, that's below average, so it's 10%. So hopefully we'll continue to see some of that be sustained. 33614, this is one that has noticeable increase in the last 2 weeks compared to its prior, 67%. 33598 has had a similar but not quite as significant increase. Notably, 33602 has shown a significant reduction in compared to the past 2 weeks, going from a brighter red to a lighter one. 33605, it's noticeable because of the steady increase. And 33511 is another one of our large increased zip codes. Next slide, please. The top zip codes are three that have shown the largest increases over a two-week period. The first one, 33573, is actually still green, so they're below the average, but that's a big increase, and it's certainly going to get our attention, and it's concerning. 33584, a similar large increase, fortunately had low numbers to begin with, but that's not a trend we want to continue. And as noted, 33567 as well. On the other end of the spectrum, if you will, the zip codes listed here have shown significant decreases. The largest, 33606, gone from one of our top zip codes in the 2 week prior to almost cutting it in half. 33602, I think we've talked about, it's one that we've looked at, again, good trends. Interesting, 33620, very small numbers, but this is one we're gonna be watching in a month or so. It is the USF campus. It'll be interesting to see if there is any change, and I know we're working closely with them to avoid an increase. And then I think the last are also similarly lightening up, if you will. 33609, still above average, but is heading in the right direction. Commissioner, I'll stop there and welcome any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Houghton. Thank you, Mr. Wagner, for that presentation. Quite enlightening, really. Commissioner Overman, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. Thank you, both Dr. Wagner, Kevin Wagner and Dr. Holt. A lot of good information, obviously a little concerning, to say the least. But the good news is the increasing is slowing, but we're still seeing an awful lot of position, a lot of cases coming in. I have a couple of questions regarding the turnaround time on lab results and testing. There's, in relation to that, average turnaround on lab notification and average turnaround on times for contact tracing to follow up. We've seen a shortening of the scheduling of the appointments, and I'm hoping that is still the case. That would be helpful as well, since we're doing such wide testing. But I know we've heard there's issues associated with labs being backed up. Can you share with me average turnaround on labs that you're experiencing right now? And then how long does it take on average for the Department of Health to reach out to those that have scheduled a test and, you know, just to and have been determined positive?
Yes, ma'am. The first question regarding the turnaround. Talked about where, again, hospitals very quick. Some of the ones that have been sent out of state have taken longer than 7 days, sometimes as long as 10 days. I don't track the public testing sites. I think Mr. Dudley may have a better sense of that. But my last understanding was it was in the 3 to 5 range on average, although some may be a little longer than that. As we talked about last week, the contact tracing first contact begins with a phone call. So we reach out to those that we have essentially close to the first day. There are always some we have not able to reach. We're not able to leave a message with. There's two things we're doing currently with the augmentation of staff that I've been talking about and some partnership with the Florida Department of Health and their virtual. We have the capability to at least contact all of the cases that are coming in. We're also looking at doing some texting automatically to at least get the process started. And the second modification we've done is we have a team that does nothing but just make that first call to say, we got your results, are you fine, and you're going to get it a call. So all of those are now operational, and we're working to reduce that time frame of the first contact. The challenges remain. The information that we get is not accurate. So about 10 to 15%, we don't have a number that is correct. And again, we're seeing, like I said before, not half, but probably close to 40% either not returning our calls or telling us much information in the call. I'll stop there.
Okay, so to follow up, how do these people find out they're positive if we don't have a phone number to let them know they're positive?
Yeah, that's a great question. They actually have access to the portal, so they can go in and check the results themselves without having a phone number. They don't need to do that to get the results on their own. The phone number is not a requirement for their login. They're given a code or something that allows them to get the result directly.
Okay. So My question would be is if when we notify them, can we begin the contract? Or, you know, if you've got them right then, get them right then. And it speeds up the contact tracing problem. And this is where I'm trying to understand how we provide any kind of guidance to maybe employers. Employers know when their employee calls in sick. Employers know when their employee says, hey, I'm thinking I need to go get a test. I'm going to stay home. So is there any opportunity for employers to help us with the contact tracing? And that becomes early on in this process. You may mention that there was curiosity on some industries that might have a greater risk than others. And that's important when we're looking at how our economy works. What we've discovered is the bars were a problem. So they were, unfortunately, for the bar owners, they were shut down and then people that work there. But is there a way that we can advise employers to help with the contact tracing so that if there is a problem in either in their employers or in contacting those employees, that they reach out and let us know how we're doing? Because my concern is people get a test, they get a positive, and then they go back to work because they don't have significant symptoms, but they're still asymptomatic viral spreaders. Let's just put it that way. Can you help with that?
Well, yes, the employers are involved. Many times they actually connect the dots even before we're able to. And as they'll say, we've got several workers out, have tested and are tested positive. And that actually gives us a head start versus our individual talking to them and then the employee one at a time will put it together. As far as the question about what people do after they're informed, either they find out themselves or we call, it is voluntary. We certainly hope strongly that they will self-isolate. It isn't a obligation. We cannot tell the employer on a single case unless we feel there is a connection to others, because that's privileged information for that person. Uh-huh. And we would not do that. In fact, many times we don't name who it is. We would just say there is an employee, and most of the time they already know it, but our rules do not allow us to divulge the name of a person unless it really furthers the public health investigation.
Okay, and then the recommendation is for an employee. This is my last question.
Okay.
The recommendation is for someone who tests positive to get retested within some period of time. Was it 14 days or so to confirm that they're negative when they do go back to work? Is that being followed up on to confirm that people are getting retested? Because you said in the past that once someone's tested, they only get counted once, even if they have to be retested. Are we following up on the retesting?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that question. This has been a hot topic for me, and I want to make it very clear. They should not be retested. We do not want somebody retested. It is not required, and it gives bad information. It can keep people out of work or isolated for up to 6 weeks, 3 months, and it has no value. They're not infectious. The CDC will allow a time-based, which is basically if you have a positive, if you're symptomatic, then 10 days after your symptoms, if you are well for 3 consecutive days, you are deemed recovered.
Okay.
If you've never had symptoms, they do date the onset from the date of the test. But yes, you're right. And there is, I've had people call me quite distressed, the health department, because they are sometimes being required to retest. the hospitals don't reach out to their staff. No one really in medical terms do that. An employer has a right to do what he wants, but I strongly would hope they don't take that option.
Thank you very much for your input. I appreciate it.
Commissioner Merman, you're recognized. Commissioner Merman, you recognize. Unmute your mic.
Microphone.
There you go. Yeah.
Thank you. And Dr. Holt, last week, Dr. Wilson told us that when people show up in the emergency department, some are admitted and then some are sent home to be monitored, though they do have symptoms. So when I look at on page 9, the COVID-related admissions from the emergency department data, how many people are being sent home to be monitored? I mean, wouldn't that be, it's kind of like an admission, but it's not exactly an admission on their books. So if you look, if the admissions are going down, but they're sending more people home to be monitored, wouldn't that be significant?
Okay. Well, participate and help monitor those individuals.
Right.
Speaking with Dr. Wilson, there are still some, but it's significantly less numbers of people coming just for testing. And again, I think I applaud the county, Mr. Dudley and others for getting those testing sites up. And as Town and Country and others become accessible, that number of people that are seen in the emergency room just for that, which is always going to inflate the number you're sending home as far as their medical condition. I do not have an exact number as far as they can't give me, or I can't tell of the number of people who they, on a daily basis, send home. Have that. I could see if they have that internally, but what I've shown you and what we had access to is just the number of times somebody comes in with COVID-like symptoms, and some of those are not positive, but of that number, how many are admitted? I'll stop there.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. And I like the information now. I feel more secure that this information is actually coming from within our community. I think I like the way it's laid out, and I feel like it's more accurate. Not that ACA is not accurate, but you know, sometimes there's lags and different things, but I think we're actually getting to the source of the numbers that we really want to see so that we can draw our own conclusions without relying on the state. Thank you.
Mayor Castor, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Holt, just a quick question. Since we saw the skyrocket in the number of positive COVID cases and associated with around the time of the opening of the bars, and now, as you stated before, with the closure of that, we're starting to see flattening and in some cases a decline. So do you have any sort of overarching projections if nothing changed, schools didn't open back as we saw them last year, continue with the adherence to the mask order, no locations where individuals can gather in large numbers. Do you see a continuation of the drop in numbers back to the May numbers that we were seeing?
Well, forecasting is dangerous with this virus, but I think the trends have clearly given us hope that that's where we're headed. We do have to continue what we're doing. And there's going to be challenges ahead, like you mentioned, whether it's the schools opening or others. But again, I think if we continue to have our public respond the way they have, I'm hopeful that the drop will not be sharp, but the trend will continue to go down. And I'll stop there.
Okay, just one quick one. Are you any closer to that aspirational goal of the number of, are you bringing on more of the contact tracers? I know you showed us that chart at the last meeting, sort of your goal and where you were at. Is the state allowing the onboarding of more contact tracers?
Yes, ma'am, they are. We've got our sort of first contingent that I talked about, and we're on target to hopefully get everybody. If they're not fully on board, they'll be hired by the 1st of August. The bridge, if you will, that we talked about has been the support from Tallahassee, the way they have created this virtual contact team, if you will, and it is that alone has almost doubled really the capacity we had before then.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Chair.
Commissioner Merman, you recognize. Okay, I see no hands. Mr. Wagner, Dr. Holt, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Ms. Beck, County Attorney update.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Miller and EPG board members. Christine Beck, County Attorney. The only thing on my update is the extension of the local state of emergency order, which, as you know, is running every seven days. And at this time, Mr. Chair, it would be appropriate to entertain any motions regarding that order.
So moved.
Approval.
That's a motion by Commissioner Overman, second by Commissioner Merman to extend the local emergency order. Is there any discussion? Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Miller?
Yes.
Overman?
Yes.
Merman?
Yes.
Chronister?
Yes.
Castor?
Yes.
Ross?
Yes.
Lott?
Yes.
Snipely?
Yes.
Motion carried 8-0.
Thank you.
You've been listening to today's Hillsborough County Emergency Policy Group meeting.